This week on The Breezy Breakfast, we hear from Brian Skerritt. Brian outlines the history of the Ontario Reformatory in Guelph and the potential for a national park being established on that site. Brian goes into detail about the site's Indigenous history and heritage, as well as its natural features. He answers questions about housing, road widening, and the suggestion that this site would be a good place for a new hospital.
Good morning, Breezy Breakfast, and welcome to another Thursday morning where we engage in lively discussion about current events, Guelph, and anything that might be of concern to us. But today in particular, we have Brian Skerritt with us to talk about a proposed national park and all of the interesting treasures that we could find at the Guelph Correctional Center. For those of you who have lived in Guelph for some time, you will be aware that the Guelph Correctional Center, or the Ontario Reformatory, was once a place, no joke, of beauty and pride. It employed many, many people. Many people, ironically, would go to the grounds there because they were beautiful to have their wedding pictures taken. Today, it has fallen into disrepair and into some controversy about what its future might be. Brian Skerritt has been meticulous in working on bringing to life many of the artifacts that are there, and we will be hearing from him today about some that people are familiar with and some that perhaps people are not familiar with, including some what I would consider to be fairly important Indigenous artifacts that we will see. And with that, I'd like to begin with the statement of acknowledgement. As we gather, let us take time to reflect on our privilege to live and work in Guelph, a city built over rich Indigenous histories. We are guests here. We should reflect upon the responsibility to care for this land, the people who live here today, and the generations to come. If our actions today can move us toward reconciliation, we should take pause and make those decisions with intention and gratitude. And before I pass it over to Brian, I would also like to point out that Breezy Breakfast truly does wish not just for a ceasefire in the Middle East, but also for peace to break out once and for all. What we have for ourselves, we desire for others as well. And with that, Brian, I'd welcome you to Breezy Breakfast to take us on this magical mystery tour of the Guelph Correctional Center lands.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, I'm now with Urban Park Guelph. We spent a lot of time even deciding what our name was going to be because we're talking about a national urban park. So some people have asked me, why isn't the word national in the title? It depends on who you ask. If you ask me, it's because there were too many syllables. If you ask somebody else, they say, because you know, if we decided isn't a national park, but we still want a park, it gives us a lot of flexibility. But when we're talking about a national urban park, I want to point out this is not what we're talking about. We're not talking about an urban park like we have at Exhibition Park or on King George Hill. We're not talking about slides and swing sets and soccer fields and baseball diamonds. We're talking about preserving nature and following the guidance of Parks Canada and the Ministry of the Environment on some guidelines they've set out. The whole story started, I don't know, we can't really read that in here, at least I can't without my glasses, but this is an excerpt from the
you want me to read it?
In my environment minister, just read the highlighted part.
I will. The highlighted part says, to ensure all Canadians have access to green spark, we establish at least one new national urban park in every province and territory with a target of 15 new urban parks by 2030.
Thank you. So that's a mandate letter from 2021, from December 2021. So shortly after that, that's when the ball started rolling. It really began with Yorklands Green Hub, who have been invested in this land for a long time, investigating the urban park, bringing other people on board to participate. And right now we've got a working group of about 10 or 11 people with representatives from RARE, from the Arboretum, from the Guelph Hiking Trail Club, of course, from Yorklands, and a couple of former Heritage Guelph members who had nowhere to go. Just so we know, this is the land we're talking about. This is a Google Earth image. And the yellow outline is what the city is proposing as the Heritage Conservation District. And that's the land that we've identified as the nucleus, and I'm really going to stress that word right now, of the urban park, because our idea is that this is a hub and it's going to be interconnected down the road. This is not the end game. This is the starting point. But we had to have somewhere to launch from, and we could have just argued about what to include, what not to include forever. So this is where we're starting. This next map is a little bit better. North End, York Road at the top, Stone Road at the bottom, Victoria Road on the left, and Watson Road on the right. It was originally 1,000 acres, 10 farm lots that the Ontario government purchased to convert into the reformatory in 1908. A lot of that's been sold off now. And of course, you were asking about the fusion lands and why, you know, how this conflicts with fusion. Well, the fusion lands are not included. This blank space right here, that's the fusion lands. That's Victoria Road. And this is important. This is the Arboretum. So, you know, with the riverway and hopefully with Fusion's development, there will be networks that can connect our proposal to the Arboretum as well. And there will be a slide toward the end that talks about that. In here, it will be houses. I believe there is supposed to be some employment land. There will be some parkland that's required as part of their development, but that's all up in the air. And frankly, I think, you know, Fusion's had to go back to the drawing board again because of the changes in Guelph's official plan, which is, you know, not even pinned down yet. So, you know, they've got their hands full trying to figure out what rules they're playing with. But we've been communicating with them. They know of our project. They haven't endorsed it, but they haven't objected to it. They haven't thrown up any red flags. So we're pleased about that. So when the government announced their plan, they're investing $130 million in the various parks. And they decided there were going to be three pillars or legs to each park that had to be achieved in order to qualify. The three pillars that Parks Canada laid out. The first one is that whatever space you're picking, it has to be a space that conserves nature. And so when we looked at this was a Yorklands Green Hub BioBlitz they did in 2014. There were, at the time, 53 bird species that they found in one day. I'm absolutely sure there are more than that. One of our Facebook friends posted this on our Facebook group. There's a yellow-throated warbler, which was not included in the previous list. So I think there's a lot more to be explored. And I know Yorklands is investigating another BioBlitz in the new year, probably toward the end of April, early May in the spring. This one was done in August, which is a little off-season for a BioBlitz. They also identified reptiles, amphibians, two turtle species, which are endangered. I think that's important to note. I don't know how they found all these moths in the day. I kind of wish I'd been there for that one. But yeah, that's a lot of moths. And we've got the Heritage River. The Aramosa River is tributary to the Grand, which is a designated Heritage River. And the various tributaries have been identified. The other part, which I really haven't had the chance to drill down on yet, Hugh Whiteley presented to City Council recently or sent a letter, and this was an excerpt from his note right here. Phil, do you want to read that one for me?
There are five Canadian cities that have identified river valley corridors as a defining feature and framework of their open space systems. These five cities are Ottawa, Guelph, London, Saskatoon, and Edmonton.
Thank you. And that's pretty important. You know, only five cities in all of Canada that have identified a river valley corridor as part of their official plan. Dr. Whiteley's got some criticism of the way the cities managed our river corridors. A national urban park could actually help contribute to Guelph's objectives and you know, hopefully address some of his concerns. These photographs, by the way, came from DA Photography. I did a tour with him last year on the grounds. And very often what happens, I take somebody on a tour of the grounds and they say, anything I can do to help perpetuate this park idea, I'm in. Draghi normally will charge for his photographs after he did the tour with me. And when we were done, he was so amazed. He said, how is it possible? I've lived here for 10 years. I didn't even know this was in my backyard. Anything you need from these photographs I took, if you're using it to advance the park, you can have them for free. And it was a lovely gesture. The old reformatory quarry, is also designated by the government, by the provincial government, as an area of natural and scientific interest. So we've got the natural component covered in spades. Pillar two is the requirement is you have to have a mechanism to connect people to nature. Well, that's an easy one. It's been done at this site for over 100 years. It's being done today. It's being done by Yorklands Green Hub, the Guelph Hiking Trail Club, the Guelph Outdoor School, the Arboretum, Guelph Urbex. That list goes on and on. Almost so that the next slides are actually groups that have endorsed us because they are also the groups that are connecting people to nature. Yorklands Green Hub, of course, the Arboretum, Guelph Urban Forest Friends. That picture is a tour I took of as landscape graduate students from University of Guelph. I took last Tuesday. Guelph Hiking Trail Club, Guelph Wellington Coalition for Social Justice, the Outdoor School, Coalition for Active Transportation. And this is not all the endorsements we have so far. RARE. Go back to that one for a minute because I just, well, partly because I'm in it. I like that.
Yeah.
But this, you know, quarry site, this is the same quarry site from the top. And it's just remarkable. And that's now owned by the city of Guelph. That's not provincial land. Focus on nature. And the Rotary Club Environmental Committee. So we've got a lot of weight. Who is that? Oh, James Gordon. Well, I'm so glad we said a lot of weight before we got to James. James is the first individual we've included in our, you know, he's not representing an organization or an NGO or a business. But he put something in his endorsement that I really liked. We've already proven that we can achieve our anticipated population growth through densification, proper planning. There's no benefit to encroaching on this precious resource with further growth. That's important. The reason I'm stepping on that line in particular is I've talked to a lot of people. I've talked to a lot of business people who have said, well, you know, what about the housing crisis? We need housing. Absolutely, we need housing. That, you know, we're not condemning Fusion Homes for building housing. That's something we have to do. The more housing we have, the more people we add to the city, the more critical having a space is that not only we can retreat to, but makes this a place where we want to live. So I was glad James put that in his endorsement. The third pillar, which when I started with Yorklands Green Hub working on this project, which I thought was going to be the most difficult, was advancing Indigenous reconciliation. And I remember saying to various people at the time, I thought, good luck with that. I'm out. How are you going to do that on this site? And we started talking and we started doing some research. And one of the things that came out was the history in particular of the Native Sons. They were the Indigenous group within the jail. So they've been described variously as a brotherhood, as a self-help group. They fought for Indigenous rights and religious rights, really, within the prison system. In 1977, they produced a book of poetry. This was actually a published book. There were six authors and contributors. It's out of print, so it's very difficult to get a copy of. We're lucky we have a copy. Bill, once again, you get to read the screen.
The caption beside the book states, "We speak because you need to understand."
I think that's pretty powerful and pretty prophetic. That is the first page of the book. And it's the stories and the poems in there are wonderful. We're still doing our due diligence with Indigenous consultations. And how we can respectfully share these materials. We haven't published them. The one exception is the author. One of the authors, I think he's the last surviving author, is a man named Freddie Taylor. He's a survivor of the Indigenous schools. There's a couple of pictures of him later. And when I spoke to Freddie, actually, I'm going to go back one. There's something on that slide that you can't see. Bill, what's it say right there? Can you read that?
Under advancing reconciliation, it says, let's call it healing.
Let's call it healing. I've talked to a lot of Indigenous individuals, and so far, nobody likes the word reconciliation. I think organizations prefer it. Band councils may prefer it. Individuals don't care for it. They say, what is reconciliation doing? So when I spoke to Freddie Taylor at Curve Lake, it was the first time I ran into this. I thought, yeah, we're going to talk about reconciliation. And a string of expletives followed. And I was taken aback. I said, well, tell me about that. So we talked about that, and he talked about that. And then I said, well, Freddie, what if we talk about healing instead? And he said, brother, if you're talking about healing, you can use anything of mine, put my name on it for free. I was blown away. This is a man, 78 years old. He went through hell on earth. He was in the residential school system for 10 years. He was in and out of the prison system for another 20 years. He wound up joining Satan's Choice. And now he has a studio at the Weetung Cultural Center at Curve Lake First Nation. And he's ready to heal. It's a little bit of the history of the Native Sons. This was included in the book. The big thing I like here is this sentence here. It says, the Native Sons have been able to grow and function effectively in Guelph Correctional Center without becoming a source of tension, conflict, or division. In fact, they have gained the respect of the other inmates, the staff, and the administration. So this was a big deal. But the other component of this, and why, you say, hey, Brian, how does this advance reconciliation? Well, the first thing we have to talk about is the fact that at the time, Indigenous population represented 11% of the prison when they represented 2% of the Canadian population. So, recognizing that there's a problem. There's Freddie, and I chose to put one of his poems in here because he gave us the opportunity to share them. I won't read that one right now. We'll save that for later. The other component, there's a couple of slides on these things, this issue. At one point, we used to think, oh, wow, look at the great things we did at the Guelph Correctional Center. We were advanced. We were, letting the Indigenous prisoners have their rights and ceremonies and so on. And when we dug a little bit below the surface, we discovered, they had to fight pretty hard for those rights. It wasn't something that the administration at the prison was prepared to just go ahead and give them. There's a letter so about 2 weeks after this article appeared with the prison superintendent denying sweat lodges and other Native rights, religious rights. This letter to the editor appeared in the paper. This was 1979. Yeah, well, it was wrong. I wound up going through every Monday, January something at the library for a long time to get it right. And then this article appeared. It says that the rights were denied by William Taylor, the superintendent, the sweat lodge, and the pipe, the sweetgrass ceremonies. But it was the Ministry of Corrections that overrode him and said, I think we've got some human rights issues here. But again, it was the Native Sons themselves and outside supporters of the Native Sons that had to clamor to make that happen. And these are two images of the sweat lodge. The first sweat, I just learned last week, the first sweat was held New Year's Eve, 1980. And it became a really, really significant component of Indigenous jail life for these men. There's another Native Son I've corresponded with. We haven't met yet. He's done an interview where he credits the sweat lodge with really saving him. And he actually runs sweats to this day, 40 years later. The man on the top right there is Cliff Summers. I just met him last week, and he invited me down to Oneida First Nation. And I participated in his new moon ceremony and was honored by watching the door of the Inipi, which is the Oneida word for the sweat lodge. I've been very impressed with how generous people have been with their time and talking about experiences, which could very well have been, or probably were some of the worst days of their lives, and unjustly so. This was another article from 1990 about the sweat lodge. This was by Tony Saxon in the Mercury at the time. And you'll notice I've gone through, you'll see these names have been redacted. One of our policies is that people who were okay with having their names published in 1980, in 1990, when they were 20 years old, may not want to be outed now, 30 or 40 years later. So we err on the side of caution. We don't want to phone somebody up and out of the blue and say, hey, we'd like to talk to you about the worst days of your life. And even though you've been trying to hide it for 30 years. So we rely on building trust. That's the thing. We have to build trust. And then that trust leads to another introduction to somebody else. And so there's been a number of introductions so far, and we're hoping for more. The last section here, and I'll try to barrel through it pretty quickly, is the question of why now? We've been talking about this for about a year. Why now? Obviously, because the federal government's provided a framework for this. But there's a bunch of other pressures on this that aren't just strictly building house development pressures. This article appeared in the Mercury in, was it February this year? I can't read it. I think it was February or March this year. This is a mural that was in the basement of the chapel. And it was painted to honor five men who died in a fire in the Stratford prison system. It was painted by, it's a 16-foot by 8-foot mural. I became aware of it through Marianne Cole, whose brother died in the fire. And she asked us to investigate this and find out if it was still accessible. We found out not only is it not accessible, the provincial government denies that it exists. The line was, there are no documented murals. So, you know, that's going to be a loss if it's not already lost. We don't know the status, the condition. You may have seen this in the news, the rocks, the stone walls. They're at risk. They're at risk from vandalism. They're at risk from, maybe it was erosion. We don't know. I see Alex Smith shaking his head. The Trestle Bridge. I think the Trestle Bridge should become a cause célèbre. One of the problems we have, and we've experienced this in the heritage world, this is invisible from the road. People can't see it. So politicians go, yeah, get rid of it. We can't see it. But the city has already identified this for demolition, despite the fact that they want to build another connecting bridge on over the river, about 500 meters away from this one. It will cost more money to rebuild the bridge. The demolition of this bridge was earmarked at about $1 million. And this is a really cool heritage bridge. Guelph Hiking Trail Club brought in wood specialist engineers who examined it and said they could restore it for $350,000 and bring it. I mean, it's not going to ever be for vehicular traffic again. This was actually a train bridge initially. Yeah, on the York Road side, right beside the ponds, the city wants to put in stormwater ponds. That's probably going to encroach on a wetland area. It's probably going to have, you know, downstream effects that we just don't know about. Sometimes, you know, there are downstream effects. There's both intended and unintended consequences. And the city hasn't been very, I would have to say they've been a little opaque on the subject. If somebody came to us and said, hey, Urban Park Guelph, we know you guys are champions of this property and we know you really want to save those ponds, and the cost of saving the ponds is a couple of stormwater management ponds, now, I'd be, you know, I don't know if I'd be all in, but I'd certainly listen to the conversation. Those conversations haven't happened. Within the lower assembly hall, one of the buildings, it is not a designated building, are these indigenous murals. We recently discovered who painted some of them. It was a known listed artist named Richard Bedwash. The murals are an easy thing to throw up on the screen and people gravitate to them. I mean, what I said to CBC when I did an interview was that for me, it's not the fact of the murals themselves. It's the fact that they existed in the native son's room. They had a room dedicated to exploring their spirituality. The fact that the native sons existed is the important part. And the fact that we're disrespecting the murals terribly. I mean, this is a before and after. This image here was sent to me by the CBC reporter who did the story. Somebody sent it to her anonymously. This was purportedly taken in 2009, so 9 years after the facility closed. And this is what it looks like now. This was a screen capture from some urban explorers that broke into the building and took some video. So that's the other component it's the disrespect of the artwork, of the Native Sons, of the history. I've inquired that apparently this was documented by the Ontario government. I made inquiries and asked for the documentation, and they said that it's for internal government use only. So I have a Freedom of Information request out for that one. This is another, this one, and this is the first time, this was the other one that was sent to us anonymously. It's the first time I've shown this publicly. I've been kind of sitting on it, waiting for the right opportunity to present it to people, and I think this is it. The reason I'm highlighting this now is right here appears to be another small mural. We've never seen that before. I don't have a good image of it. I can't draw a bead on who created it. But if I advance to the next slide, that's where it should be. And it's gone. The paint's peeled off the walls. So I think we've already suffered an irretrievable loss of a cultural artifact. This is the other reason why now. Half of the women in Canada's federal prison are Indigenous. So we've gone from a time in 1977 where 11% of the inmates at Guelph were Indigenous. We're going in the wrong direction, folks. I mean, this is the kind of thing that it blew my mind when I started learning this. Federally, the number is 35% across Canada. And for women, it's 50% across Canada that are Indigenous. It's just an astonishing number. Oh, and this is the other problem with this project. We have an embarrassment of riches. There are too many things to talk about. There was going to be a whole section of this presentation called, "Oh, but what about?" Because I know there's going to be people that say, "Oh, what about this? What about that?" One of the whatabouts is the fact that there's a, not directly on the site, but adjacent to the site, is an archaeological footprint. It was explored in the 90s, and the artifacts that were brought up went back 10,000 years. It was dated back three specific archaeological eras, but the oldest one was 8500 BC. That was something else I had to get from a Freedom of Information request. That's the headline of the report that I got. You may recognize this is more or less the land here. This is city-owned land on the right-hand side where they're putting their Guelph transit facilities. It was originally going to be the operations master campus. They've scaled that back, but they're still planning. And interestingly, within the Heritage Conservation District boundaries, they've decided that's where the parking lot should go. And we're getting toward the end. This is an important slide, this one and the next one. This illustrates why we talk about it being a hub. And this is important to a couple of men, particularly important to a couple of our members, Alex Smith, Paul Kraling, shout out to you both. This is where the park is right now. This is what we're talking about as the hub. This is the reformatory lands. It can connect all these other places. You go to Niska Road, Niska Park. You can go to Rockwood and go south to Starkey Hill. We can incorporate Guelph Lake. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, and all of those places can be part of a designated national park system. But again, going back to what I said at the beginning, we didn't incorporate that because it just becomes too much to wrap our hands around, too much to create a soundbite around. But that's the end game. So when we're talking about what we're thinking of for the urban park, that's just the beginning. It's a further map. So this is the city, and here are more pointers to the outlying parts that could be included. And then we, this is the last slide. We get back to the petition. You can look up the petition online. It's there's a QR code here on the screen. It's petition E4593, if anybody's Googling it. And it gives a pretty good summary of our goals. And you can also find it at www.urbanparkguelph.com. The link to the petition's on the landing page. There's a list of all the endorsements and a list of some of our donors to date.
Excellent presentation, Brian, and I'm not going to let you go yet. Yeah. We have a number of questions, and I think I'm going to start with the first one, I think, is going to come from this slide right here. Brian, I'm just kind of curious. You mentioned people signing the petition. Have you engaged Indigenous groups or Indigenous activists for the same purpose? It seems that if there was a national will or a provincial will to make this a heritage site, that it would be strong fodder for making the Correction Center a park area.
It's a good question. It's a little tricky to answer. Because this is a federal petition at Parliament, everybody who signs it is anonymous. They protect everybody's identity. So we may have had people signing it representing Indigenous organizations. I don't know. So it's kind of a double question that you're asking. Have we engaged and have they participated in the petition? As far as the petition goes, we don't know. We have had ongoing conversations with the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation because they are the treaty territory. This is their treaty territory. And we have done other outreach, and those conversations are ongoing. Those conversations, I think, will always be ongoing.
And that actually raises another question. I hope you don't mind. Maybe you don't have the ability to answer it. You talked about the Mississauga as being the government or the group with whom you are interacting. Is that an issue, or is that something that is fairly straightforward? There are a number of Indigenous groups that were represented within the population of the Correction Center. So I'm just wondering about Indigenous, non-Indigenous relations and how that can play out in this.
You lost me with the last Indigenous, non-Indigenous part, but the rest of it I can answer. We are having conversation with Mississaugas in particular because they are the government. They had this, and at some point, you know, I'd like to really make myself redundant and not be the front man for this. I want the city involved. I want the province involved. I want government to government conversations to be happening. But we are having conversation with Mississaugas, but we're also having conversations with the local community. And with, as I've mentioned, I've been to Curve Lake, I've been to Oneida First Nation, reaching out to Native Sons. I've got a map that I didn't include here, which has a pin on every First Nation that was affected by having a Native Son at the reformatory.
How many are there approximately?
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, it's early days. How many nations?
Yes.
It's well over 20 already.
Wow. Okay. Thanks.
And so the interesting thing is that even when you could look at the prison population at any time was probably between 15 and 30 members. But every one of those members represented a family and a community that was affected by them being incarcerated. Mm-hmm. So it was the multiplier effect is massive.
John, you had a couple of points you wanted to raise.
Yeah, so it was a bit of a we've all kind of been happy about the news that the York Road was being downsized to the to two lanes rather than four lanes, but that was kind of the incentive for the city to be negotiating with the province on the property. So I was just wondering, by abandoning that plan, and it was to move Clyde Creek and stuff like that, which is all not good. What's the impact of that? Has the city really now kind of walked away from negotiating? Because part of those negotiations, we understood also, were to do with the Trestle Bridge. The Trestle Bridge, there's like a little finger south of the major OR property that goes behind Cargill, that is owned by Infrastructure Ontario, and it includes the bridges there. So is that still actively being negotiated for, or is that just now fallen off the table, basically? So that's a concern that I have.
Okay. So I'm celebrating the saving of Clyde Creek and the fact that it's not being moved. And that was announced as part of the budget. So I haven't spoken to anybody in the city about their plans. When we did make inquiries about their, purchasing from the province, it was in negotiation, and so it was being kept private, which is understandable. My guess is that they are probably still negotiating to buy land for the stormwater ponds, and possibly for the trestle bridge. I'm not sure, because that was not specifically presented to city council as a savings device when the budget was presented, in the same way that Clyde Creek, the walk back on Clyde Creek was. So I'm reading between the lines a little bit and interpreting what came out of that, but that would be my guess, is that the plans for the stormwater management ponds in particular are still underway, and that the land for that would have to be purchased. I'm not so sure about the trestle bridge. As far as I know, that's also still in the stormwater management master plan, recommending demolition. Although, as the city has pointed out, that's contingent on the outcome of a Heritage Conservation District boundary, the conservation plan, and it's ultimately owned by the province, who have also declared that they want to demolish it. So keep up the good work, John. I think we still have to keep working to save the bridge.
But I'm hoping that Aaron Caton might be there. There she is, Aaron. I was wondering if you might contribute, because the York Road expansion is an interesting issue where council just might be all over the place on this.
Well, I'm personally very happy. It was one of the things that I campaigned on, is that I didn't want to have to deal with the moving of Clyde Creek, because I felt that it was a poor choice for the animals in the area and for the heritage. So the expansion of York Road it's a lot cheaper, for one, to only do two lanes. And the timing of it is another issue that I'm not necessarily happy about, the timeline, but the creek itself not being moved, I think, is a good thing.
I think that's really important. I would also suggest that this is one example of the law of unintended consequences being positive. In my opinion, the era of four-lane roads is long gone in urban areas. I'm not a fan of them anywhere, but if we really want to get people out of cars, we should be looking at different approaches. And I think Aaron and I are on the same page that a two-lane road with effective multi-use paths associated with those has many benefits. Cost is one of them. Preserving of Clive Creek is another one. And really getting people out of their cars as much as possible. Plus, Aaron, I think that you had a very personal concern, and that was with a pedestrian crossover. Do you want to just make a quick comment about that and about why that's necessary in that area?
Yes, there's a whole community in that area that was built long before a lot of the other portions of Guelph were, and they don't even have sidewalks, and they don't have any access to green space within that area. They're kind of landlocked there because they're nestled in between York Road and the railway. So they actually need a pedestrian crosswalk to have access to the green space in the Yorklands. So I would really like that to happen in a more accelerated fashion, because if we give it another year to finish York Road, they're at the end portion of that. So that means that they wouldn't get a pedestrian crosswalk until 2027. And that's just not acceptable.
Okay. And I see that John Fisher has one more point that he wants to raise. So I'm going to go with John, and then Ron in the restaurant's got a question. So John, go ahead.
We have been having ongoing conversation with the Parks Department about the Trestle Bridge, who have been our kind of front people for Gene Matthews for all things to do with IO, I guess. And in our last meeting, we did say, would you entertain having Wood Research and Design come and speak to city engineers and so on about restoring the bridge? And at the same time, we would have a town hall about it as well, because some people look at that bridge and say, well, Jesus, nothing, you know, it's falling down. There's just nothing you can do about that. And I think you would be very convinced hearing from Wood Research Design that it actually is very, very much repair and repurposable. So we actually had Dan Tingley, who's the president of the company, who's doing work in Tillsonburg right now, was willing to come in and do that. But his timing was for budget week. So we said, look, this is not a good week to come in and talk to people. People will be focused on a lot of other things. So we put that off until probably the early part of next year. But we are looking to do that, and hopefully to educate engineers who generally don't know much about wooden bridges anymore. They just know about concrete and steel. And so we hope we can pull that off with the city in the new year. That's it.
I got to reiterate that I think that it is a very positive endeavor. We've had many people with engineering experience go out there, including Ted Tacoma, who believes that there is potential, and I look forward to that. I'm going to go to Ron, if you could come up here, and then Mike Darman wishes to make a comment as well.
Thanks, Phil, and thank you, Brian. That was an excellent presentation. You indicated during your presentation that there seems to be some resistance from the city to the notion of a national urban park. So what is the situation with regards to the city? Are they actually endorsing the notion of the national park, or have they remained neutral, or are they giving you difficulty?
Good question. I didn't mean to imply anywhere that they were that the city objected to the park. I think that there are elements of the land and in the conservation district where we have opposing views, and that may have been, you know, what you were referring to. As far as we have had conversations with Scott Stewart, with Gene Matthews. I would say the city has been neutral on it so far. And fair enough. I mean, obviously, we're in a budget crunch right now. They've got a lot on their plates. But city staff will also respond to council direction. And so, well, we're working right now on the petition, on pushing the federal government, on getting the groundwork laid, on making people aware. And as that builds, when we've got the petition closes in the middle of January. When we have... however many signatures we're going to have at that point, we can also not just present it in Parliament, but then we can go back to City Council and say, look, we have this many petitions. We have this many active endorsers. We have this many people that turned out at Breezy Breakfast. We need to drive, because politicians are great leaders when they follow.
I'm going to have to think about that one.
President Company accepted. But yeah, you too, Aaron. But we want to get ahead of the curve. We want to make this, you know, as accessible and as, you know, it's actually, there's a lot in it for Guelph. There's a lot in it for the city, and it can alleviate a lot of the pressures and challenges that the city has if we do it right and we bring everybody together, put everybody in the same room on the same page. Scott Stewart privately privately, here I am announcing privately. I wouldn't say he was encouraging, because I don't want to put words in his mouth. But he engaged in a very animated conversation. He was very interested, gave us some ideas, and was expansive. So I would say when the time comes that we are going to have conversations with the city, preferably with the direction of council, that they will probably, you know, come with open arms. That's my hope.
And before I get to people that are in the restaurant and to Mike, I just want to follow up on that. With regards to the various levels of government, it's in my opinion, but it would strike me that the city at this point is the least of our concerns. We need to get the provincial and the federal governments more on side first. Is that a correct assumption?
No.
Oops. Well, explain to me why. Explain to me why.
There is no least important component. In our conversations with, sort of backroom conversations with the Ministry of the Environment, they're very keen to see the city involved and supportive. I don't think it goes forward without the city. I mean, the city owns the land. They own that quarry site. The city has to be involved. They have to come to the table and they have to want to do this. So again, that's where it comes down to the direction of council. The provincial government, we've done outreach to Infrastructure Ontario and had no reply. I had an email yesterday from somebody who said, you absolutely have, Infrastructure Ontario owns the land. You have to get them on board. And I corrected him and I said, no, you know what? Infrastructure Ontario doesn't own the land. They're a property manager. They're a property manager that gets things ready for development. The province of Ontario owns the land. So we have to negotiate with the right channels at the province of Ontario and get them on board. Again, it goes to, leading from the ground up. If we get thousands of signatures on the petition, we get a groundswell of interest. We get letters to the editor. We have Indigenous support. We start building a package that even if, I said to one of the papers interviewed me at the beginning, if we don't become one of the 15 parks, we have to make this project so awesome and spectacular that Parks Canada has no choice but to say, oh, we need to make a 16th park. That's the goal.
Well stated. And just to point out that Paul Kraling identifies that the petition is now approaching 1,000 signatures, and I think we need probably 60 or 70,000 more.
Exactly.
With regards to petitions and getting out there and doing things, Mike Darman, you are there somewhere and want to make a comment or ask a question.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Great. Okay, it was just back to the Trestle Bridge again. And the importance of keeping it as an active transportation connector. I was at the Cuttenfields budget breakfast just a short time ago, and the Fusion representative came right up to us and restated their commitment to making their development of the GID a walkable city within a city, and that's going to have 6,000 residents living there. And they're super interested in, our vision also of connecting the GID to the rest of the city, including by the Trestle Bridge, the Trans-Canada Trail extension that we've been advocating for, and multiple other ways. Because, obviously the more you make a development attractive with adding trails and even the urban park, for instance, would be an amazing attraction for somebody living in the GID. So I just wanted to bring that up that, Fusion themselves actually also would like to see this bridge preserved too. I hope they actually follow up with some maybe contribution if that's necessary in the future. Maybe Brian could comment on that too. And one other quick thing too is the, Aaron mentioned the crossover at York Road. That's very important for us as well. I've talked to the same people living in that area. But there's also a study looking at an underpass under the Metrolinx railway up at City View. Now, if you can imagine if that happened as well, you would join that whole neighborhood beyond the Metrolinx and again back over to the GID and into the urban park area. So the whole thing is like, if we get it all together, we'd have this amazing connectivity in the city and to the GID.
Great. Thanks, Mike. That I didn't know about the underpass plan. That really is interesting and attractive. And speaking of the Trans-Canada Trail System, you may also want to check out the minister's mandate letter, because that trail system was also identified as something for the Ministry of the Environment to be growing. The conversations, we have had conversations with Fusion.
I think those conversations will also be ongoing. It was early days when we spoke to them. We hadn't started the petition. We hadn't had public conversations. Right now, the list of people we need to have conversations with is growing every day. It's growing almost as fast as the number of endorsers. I should speak right now and mention that one of the endorsements I didn't put on the chart was we got endorsed by the Provincial Liberal Riding Association just yesterday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So where we, you know, the politicians are reluctant for a variety of reasons to endorse the project, but riding associations may be stepping forward to speak up. And I think that's important.
I'm just going to go to Warren.
Thanks, Bill. Hey, Bri, just an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
I was at a meeting with Rotary, and one of the things that came up was the hospital and needing 60 acres of land. And the question was, or the answer was, well, the natural position for a new hospital in Guelph is the reformatory lands. Have you had anything or heard anything on this? You're smiling.
Why is it the natural place? I don't understand why it's the natural place. I mean, it's got space. Yeah, I've got a few opinions on that. And it's a layered and complex issue. And I think that's one of the reasons some of the politicians have been wary about stepping into the fray or speaking up. The hospital has to go through a whole lot of exercises before they're in a position to actually expand. They have to prove that they can't adapt the land that they're on. They have to, if they move, the guidelines state that they should be moving to a property that's minimum 50 acres, 50 to 60. But there have already been exceptions to that rule, so that they can work around that. I've thought quite a bit because we don't want to, we don't want to put this into a thing where we're pitting the hospital against the park. You know, I was on the Citizens Advisory Committee when we built the Performing Arts Center, and it was always, what about fire station? We need another fire station more than we need a Performing Arts Center. A hospital has to be purpose-built. They can't incorporate any of the heritage buildings, which are now designated. They were designated as buildings of provincial heritage significance. So either city council would have to walk back all those designations, or we would need an MZO. So there's a lot of politics and issues with having the hospital on that site. And I will raise as many politics and issues as I need to preserve this for the park. Now, when you consider the land that was sold to Fusion for development, that would have been a good site for a hospital. That was flat. That was, that was where, somebody wasn't thinking outside the box, or, the government was more keen on flipping the land at that point. But there are other places for hospitals. That's why I would reject the notion that it is the natural place.
Okay, let's go to Jonathan up the front.
Brian, thank you for this. You've mentioned a couple of times the difficulty of getting politicians to commit to endorsing. I was wondering, has Lloyd Longfield, the federal MP, weighed in at all? And if so, has he given any indication of what you're up against in making this happen? Because it strikes me that it's a pretty big deal.
It is a pretty big deal. Lloyd hasn't publicly endorsed the project, but you may recall, some people in this room may recall, that at a breezy breakfast that he was at last year, or was it earlier this year, Alex? I think it was earlier this year. He said he indicated support for an urban park in Guelph, particularly as part of our 2027 celebrations. So I think, to be fair to Lloyd, I think that was a private opinion that he was offering as an individual. That wasn't a public opinion as an MP. So that's where Lloyd, when we went to Lloyd, we asked him if he would be, the word isn't sponsor, but somebody from, you have to have an MP adopt your petition at Parliament. And he was very, very eager to do that. So I think we have tacit support from Lloyd, if not public.
And actually, I just ask a quick question related to that. Mike Schreiner, do we need Mike Schreiner's support, or is Mike really out of it because it's just a land sale?
you know, again, I don't want to put words in Mike's mouth. We've spoken to Mike. You know, I think he's walking a fine line because he has multiple constituents who have multiple spheres of interest. So we'd like to have Mike on board at some point, but at this point, he's continuing conversations with us.
Okay, thanks. I'm just going to pass the microphone over to Rob.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for an excellent overview of the long-term history of that site, and I'm fully supportive of what you're trying to do. As a retired engineer, I had to comment on the trestle bridge. I was there at the inspection, and frankly, the superstructure of that bridge, timber-wise, is in spectacular condition, apart from the deck, which is superficial, so it's very cheap to fix. So those timbers will not be found anywhere in Ontario in such good condition. And they were designed to carry a railroad, so they could have depreciated by over 50% and still carry a couple of mountain bikes on a bikeless trail. The two other components of that bridge are the piles, and the piles above ground are in excellent condition, and below the splash zone, below the water, they're also in excellent condition, protected, but the splash zone needs some repair. And that's something that the engineer that came out was very, very capable of repairing. The other aspect is the abutments, and they've slipped, but the timbers that form them are in excellent condition, and that can be reconstructed without any major engineering work. So the fact that that's not being retained or that it's scheduled for demolition is a nonsense for the purpose that they're trying to do. And I'd stand up in any venue and fight for that. And yes, I did spend some time with timber in my engineering career design. So the other point that I'd just like to add, it's completely separate, was when we talked about healing and the Indigenous, it was very powerful. But I think there's another era of healing that's gone on that property with regards to the First World War convalescent home. And not so much the actual building and the guys recuperating in a bed, but I'm sure they were wheeled out to try and get their bodies back in shape and spend a lot of time outside enjoying the surroundings in a very peaceful environment. And that's more current and very current with the Remembrance Day. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
It is true. We have omitted the role of that property during World War One. I was wondering if you could just give us a Reader's Digest of that.
Yeah, I knew somebody was going to bring up the what about, you know. So Reader's Digest version, in 1917, the facility was closed to become a convalescent hospital. There's actually some good images. We've got some good photographs of that era. And I'm pretty sure I've got a picture of royalty. I've got a footage of royalty touring and shaking hands at the time.
Okay.
It was the Prince of Wales. He was there.
All right.
So it was 4 years. It reopened as a reformatory in 1921.
Excellent history. And with that, I'm going to go to a real prince of a guy, John.
Brian, there's lots of fiscal pressure on all levels of government. This is going to have an ongoing cost, obviously.
Yep.
Should you get your wish, it's going to need staffing, it's going to need maintenance, it's going to need all of those good things.
Jobs.
And
creates jobs.
You're going to have to convince all levels of government that they can pay for this.
Yep.
How do you propose to do that?
Well, this is an area we're just beginning to explore, because frankly, you know, we are all here because we want a park. We were all here because we want to advance healing. All those good reasons. We weren't here to make economic arguments, but we've realized that that's going to be an important part to bringing certain people and bodies to the table. So we've begun that. I can tell you, I just came across a paper. This was related to the states. Spending at national parks in the U.S. Is a return on investment of 10 to 1. $10 spent by visitors for every dollar invested in the national park. You know, if the Canadian stats were half that, that's still a pretty good ROI. So we're just beginning those conversations, but every economic study I've found, and I've found a half dozen so far, points to job creation, quality of life. There was a whole study that I've barely had a chance to digest that says that the health benefits of having a national park, of parks, decrease the cost of healthcare. So that has to be incorporated into your valuing, your evaluation of what the park provides. So I when we get there, when we drill down on all that data that we have, and we want to get possibly the Lang School of Business involved in doing something specific for this site. But when we get into those conversations, I've got no doubt that we're going to prove that there's a net economic benefit that far outweighs the cost.
And thanks for that, Brian. I'm going to wait in a bit. Maybe Aaron, if he's still there, might want to contribute. One of my concerns is that I think irrespective of the economic benefit, what we also have to look at is social and cultural benefit, and whether the city or a municipality or a province or even a country is behind something. I look at Exhibition Park, and I don't see a whole lot of economic...
We could put the hospital there.
We could... I don't see a whole lot of economic value to it. So I don't know, maybe we should put an automobile plant there. On the other hand, I see a tremendous amount of value to the community and quality of life. It will certainly require perseverance from the community, much like the Performing Arts Center did, which ultimately ended up being the River Run Center. And we need to have a good Guelph try at this one. I think, sell politicians on why this matters. Aaron, do you have anything to say on this?
So I talked to the city about, whether or not we would purchase the land and turn it into a park. And it was an economic decision in terms of, it wasn't that the park wasn't worth it. It was the cost of the land, the cost of maintaining it, and the different heritage pieces on it, and how much that would impact our budget, more so than whether or not it was a great idea or that people would like it. So that's what I heard from city staff when I talked about us acquiring it for parklands. It being a green space that is maintained by the province or by the federal government, they definitely were interested in that from my conversations. But I think politically it's a great idea. It's just a cost.
I'm going to just jump in because you sort of touched on something by accident that I don't know if you knew you touched on, but is governance. And is whether this is city-owned land or provincially owned land or federally owned land or privately owned land, because there's there is a piece of privately owned land in what we've described as the Heritage Conservation District. This is kind of the boring, nerdy stuff, but I am really excited about what Parks Canada put forward as the governance plan. This is not a national park like Banff that's just top-down managed by Parks Canada. It can have multiple owners. The university could participate and be an owner of the Arboretum and include that in the national park and have a seat at the governance table. The First Nations will definitely have a seat at the governance table, even if they're not a landowner. The city is a landowner. They can be at the governance table. Anybody who is part of the governing body can say, hey, at any point, we demand a review of the park, the process, the policies, what we're doing. Are we meeting what we set out to do as part of our mandate? Reviews happen automatically every 5 years. There's a lot of stuff in the details that's actually really good. It's built in to allow as much flexibility and support from as many bodies as possible. So I think that's something else the city could get behind.
And Susan had a comment. Then I'm going to go to Morgan, Tanya, as our last commenter, and then we can go to announcement.
Just a short comment. We're the only city in Canada that has the Trans-Canada Trail going through a cemetery. So we could be the only city in Canada that has the Trans-Canada Trail going through a prison. So that would make it even more unique. It is listed the Pearl property is unique in Canada, as you know, so that would give us an additional uniqueness to sell.
I just wanted to make a comment about how Parks Canada works. I had the pleasure of working for the reservation group for Parks Canada, so I got a little bit of an inside view on how dedicated they are to making sure that not only the property itself, but the surrounding community is supportive of the location. And just from, I know you're saying Banff is top down all Parks Canada, but the number of people that have to take a bus from inside the city of Banff out to where the viewing sites are at Banff Lake and Moraine Lake, the amount of money that goes through there is insane. Every single person that enters in is required to pay a daily admittance fee. You can purchase a national pass for a year or a season, but all that money, that the daily, there is a specific portion of it that is earmarked and dedicated to the upkeep, preservation, and enhancement for the enjoyment of the people that attend the parks. So that's something that I would really be looking forward to, is the reformatory being taken care of by an entity that knows what it's doing.
Thanks, Morgan. And with that, Brian, I really want to thank you for the presentation today. It's been incredibly informative.
www.urbanparkwealth.com. Let's see if we can push it over 1,000 signatures as a result of this presentation today.
Thanks, Brian. And again, we've had a great number of questions from people participating in Breezy. For those of you that are listening to this on our podcast or on CFRU 93.3 FM, please consider joining us on Thursday morning downtown at the Rise and Shine restaurant, where Bev will attend to your every need. Just don't give her any sass, or she will give it back.
Okay, so we've got some announcements. There is a council planning meeting next Tuesday, the 21st of November at 6:30 p.m. On the agenda are two intentions to designate and two public meetings. One is at 151 Bristol Street. There is one housing unit there now, and the proposal is for two semi-detached and four accessory apartments. On 14 Stevenson Street North, one unit is currently there, and the proposal is to have 10 units there. Upcoming council meetings, Wednesday, the 22nd of November, Tuesday, the 28th of November, and Wednesday, the 29th of November. Those will be budget meetings. There is a Ward 2 budget town hall this Monday, November the 20th at 6:30 p.m. It's in the Margaret McKinnon Room in City Hall. Please have your say. The University Village Park, please vote for one of two accessible designs. Please have your say, the Ontario Edition, Bill 136, the Greenbelt Statute Law Amendment Act 2023, will restore the 15 parcels of land that were removed last year to the Greenbelt. Furthermore, it will ensure that any future boundary changes are done in an open, public, and transparent legislative process. Please Google ERO Greenbelt 2023 and comment by November 30th. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we're going to be talking about men's mental health, and our guest is registered psychotherapist Dave Robinson. And coming soon to Breezy Breakfast, food security and books, films, and holiday cheer. And with that, I believe it's a wrap. Thank you all for being here, and we'll see you next week.
That's all for today. Thanks for tuning in. Join us every Thursday morning at the Rise and Shine restaurant in downtown Guelph at 8 a.m. or listen to our show at CFRU 93.3 FM on Mondays at 9 a.m., or check out our podcast at thebreezybreakfastradiohour.podbean.com. Breezy Breakfast, where the conversation and the eggs are both sunny side up.